David Flaherty, Marketing Director for Washington Wine, and this is Sommelite. Sommelite is a conversation series where we talk to some of our favorite wine pros from around the country, talk a little bit of shop, but more importantly, find out what makes them human and what makes them tick. I'm super excited today to welcome to the show Lenny Redet. Lenny is a restaurateur, chef, wine steward, and educator with over 35 years of industry experience. He's currently working as a wine steward for Metropolitan Market on Mercer Island here in Seattle. He's a classically trained chef and has done everything from catering for Paul Allen's private jet, having his dessert served for presidential state dinners, and even presenting high tea for the late Princess Diana. In addition to all that, he's a chef instructor for the Northwest Wine Academy here at South Seattle College. Lenny, it's awesome to see you, my man. First off, where are you and how are you?
I'm at home in my little bungalow, my little hole here, and just getting ready for school tomorrow.
It's such a cozy bungalow.
Yeah. Yeah. I love my little apartment, and people are very, very jealous of it. It's basically like an artist's loft if you were a chef. I have the best kitchen. It's butcher block countertops and stainless steel and gas range, stainless steel hood, but it's a studio apartment.
I'm bummed that we didn't do this discussion over your butcher block table while you prepare some French sauces for us.
Yeah, I could have been cooking while we talked. It's absolutely wonderful. I love my little place. And it's basically, it's my apartment is 3/4 kitchen. But it is. It's like somebody built an artist studio for a chef. It's awesome.
Well, it's good to see you, my man. So, all right, you are a very well-known chef. You're also an incredibly experienced teacher of the culinary arts, in addition to all of your wine knowledge and all the great things you do with wine. So you're a baker as well. So we're going to kick this off. I have a question for you. So I am holding pictures of 3 cakes, and I want you to tell me which cake you, as a professional baker, are most impressed by. So first off, we have unicorn cake.
That's very pretty.
I mean, that's look at the wing.
Yeah. I mean, yes. And I'm always so impressed by chefs that can do that sort of stuff. You know, I mean, it really is beyond like the culinary skill set into the, I'm an artist who actually happens to work in like marzipan and fondant. Yeah.
Marzipan and unicorns.
Marzipan and unicorns.
That's my medium.
That could be it. Yeah.
Next up is the 18 piece. Chicken McNuggets cake.
That's really cute.
With a drink.
Yeah, I know, with the drink. Those are awfully huge McNuggets compared to the drink. But hey, it's all about the nuggets. Yeah,
you're going to need more sugar water to wash down. Healthy nuggets. Last up, which my son was most impressed by. So this is the 8-year-old's pick. This is a Mount Rushmore.
That's actually really quite impressive. Yeah. Yeah, that really is impressive. And yeah, I'm always blown away by people that can do that. My first wedding cake that I ever did was actually a 6-foot-tall Empire State Building, right? With King Kong and Fay Wray, King Kong in a tux and Fay Wray in a wedding gown hanging off the top of the Empire State Building.
Wow. As I actually proposed to my wife on the top of the Empire State Building. So
the groom's name was last name was Kong, and all of his friends called him King Kong. So hence the wedding cake.
Yeah. Did he climb up on the cake at the end of the
I hope not. I wasn't there that long.
Oh, you didn't get to see it. Well, let's talk about that. So, you know, you spent your life in wine and food. Mm-hmm. You've seen so many different angles of the business. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty rare for a lot of us in the business to have seen what you've seen and done what you've done. Mm-hmm. So looking back on all that you've done, what was the most formative period for you in terms of learning?
I lucked out. I moved to Seattle in 85. And a big part of the reason why I moved here was the opportunity to do theater. And my first job was actually at the Empty Space and working on a Rocky Horror Show, doing design and theater, because that's a whole nother story. And we could talk about that later. Grew up, my aunt owned a restaurant. Right. So I started bust my first tables when I was 10. So I kind of grew up. So I knew my way around, worked in kitchens in high school. And so I basically had a job, you know, working in kitchens. And then it was one of those things that I kind of lucked into Long story short, I lucked into a position where I was able to work for a man named Silvio Plaz. And he was the founder and executive chef of the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco. And during the 80s, any chef of any note that I was working with in Seattle had either gone to CIA in Hyde Park or they'd gone to CCA in San Francisco. And I basically lucked my way into being a sous chef. And then basically he took me under his wing and gave me this classic Swiss apprenticeship where it was like, I remember lots of crying. But it was at one particular moment, I remember I grabbed the wrong cut of meat for something that he asked me to do. And the next week, a half side of a cow, this is back when you could still get a side of a cow, came in. And we went through and cut through the whole thing. And he identified every cut. And he goes, this is the tendon. This is the tendon. This is Chateaubriand. And he broke down everything. And so it wasn't until years later when I was teaching culinary and I was teaching at Cordon Bleu that I realized the quality of the training that I got from this man working side by side with him, you know, 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week.
How old were you at the time?
I was young and beautiful then. I was in my 20s. I was in my early 20s.
Last year.
Yeah. I was in my early 20s. It really was. And again, this was part of the thing where I think there was a couple skill set that I had. One was, because I was a designer and I did, you know, set design and lighting design and so on. And I could make things pretty. And I think before I learned how to make things taste really good, I can make them look really good. And that went a long way. And so I started out doing banquets and doing garde-manger and doing catering. And really that was kind of my foothold into the culinary world. And then I had to learn how to cook. And Silvio taught me how to cook. But then I get bored easy. And so I studied baking and pastry. And initially my idea behind studying baking and pastry was so that I could manage my bakers. You know, what do you need this $10 pound chocolate versus that $2 pound chocolate? And then I fell in love with baking and, you know, went and started making cakes and desserts and, you know, and it was, and I think that was the thing. And for me, it's all connected, whether you're talking about wine or food or baking or all of it. To me, it's all the same. I mean, and again, that's really my relationship as a chef. And I ended up buying wine going all the way back into the 80s. I always ended up running the wine program because I knew more about wine than anybody else happened in the restaurant. So, you know, so I started buying wine and doing the wine program just as part of my job of buying for the restaurant.
You know people, you know, in different regards. Mm-hmm. And like, I knew you as a wine person first. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people probably know you as a teacher or, you know, they knew you as an owner or they knew you as a chef and they knew you as a, you know, and I knew you as a wine person. Mm-hmm. So how is your background? Because I mean, you've had a pretty unique path, right? Like some people end up, they are back at the house in the kitchen. They want to go work front of the house. You know, name the reason why, mm-hmm. like the better lifestyle,
money, better hours,
et cetera. You've kind of like, you know, really jumped between the two. How has your background as a chef, how has that informed what you're like as a wine buyer?
Well, it's always about the food and it's always about the dining. And it's that thing of when somebody's buying a wine, whether it's retail or restaurant, you know, I think that they should have a say in it. But I really think that just with like food, if people are going to bring, they're going to eat something, they should have a say in it in terms of like how it's prepared, whether or not they want the sauce on the side or not. And it's the same thing with wine. I don't think that there's necessarily a right answer when it comes to the perfect pairing for a wine for a dinner. There's a really good example. There was, we were at Esquin and there was a girl that worked there that had her sampin and this couple they're going to have curry for dinner and she was recommending Riesling and they were kind of, there's some pushback there and she called, well, Lenny's a chef and he teaches food and wine pairing. Let's see what he has to say. And I come up, what are you having? I was going to help you. And they're like, well, and she's like, I recommended Riesling to go with the curry. I think that'd be a perfect pairing. And I look at them and they got this look on their face. And I'm like, whoa, what do you guys normally drink? Well, we love Australian Shiraz. And I'm like, oh, okay. But the only problem with Australian Shiraz, with the curry, the alcohol, and you might, you know, with the spice, maybe something a little lower alcohol. Have you ever had a Syrah from the Rhone Valley? And they're like, no, what's that? And I go, well, that's where Shiraz comes from. And kind of took them on this little journey. What do you want to spend? Oh, no more than 15 bucks. I'm like, here you go. St. Colm, Côte de Rhone, great score, lower alcohol. I think you'll have a great time. And ding, ding, they leave, they're happy. And she's like, don't you think that the Riesling would be a better pairing? They don't like Riesling. They want Syrah, you know, they want Shiraz. Yeah. And that's that thing of, there is that perfect answer that, you know, this is the perfect pairing for this. This is the classic pairing. And then there's what the customer actually wants.
I mean, it's interesting, like you teach cooking, right? So you probably you're pretty regimented about what you're teaching. My guess is you didn't have as formal of a wine education. It sounds like wine was just part of everything you were doing. Uh-huh. Right? So do you feel like as a whole, you might treat the cooking and the food more precious than you do the wine? And that actually gives you leg up, or is it?
There are those wines, there are those foods, and there are being those really, truly precious. So we've all had those dining experiences. I mean, I'm thinking of being on top of a mountain in Valpolicella and having this amazing dinner at this winery and prepared, and one of those. And we've all had those experiences where you're having this amazing food with this amazing wine and you don't want to be anywhere else. But there is this thing where people, lots of times, they just want to have something to eat and they want to have something to drink. And it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be precious. A great bottle of wine will improve any dinner. Right. No matter whether you're having Shake Shack and, you know, 2010, you know, Chateau Latour, you know, it's like that'll improve that Shake Shack. But there's, I don't know, the way I always tell people is, you know, there's no right or wrong answers. There are better answers, but there's no right or wrong answer. It's a heuristic.
But I love that about you. You don't treat wine overly preciously, mm-hmm. and you know your stuff, you know, and it's like, I feel like there needs to be more of people like you. And maybe myself as well, like to think of my better days, like we take this product too seriously.
Well, yeah. I think if you notice, because you have the luxury of talking to like literally the greatest wine minds on the planet, right? That is such a privilege that few of us get. I mean, quite literally the greatest wine minds. And if you'll notice, if there's a common thread through all of them, is they really love wine. And they're generally pretty humble about it. They're just as likely to grab Shake Shack and a bottle of Chateau Latour. Their love and their affection is not obsessive. So you have to be kind of obsessive to understand all the villages in Burgundy and, you know, all the terroir and Clément. But that's part of the reason why you really, truly enjoy having Shake Shack and Chateau Latour.
I love that. Shake Shack and Chateau Latour. That should be your autobiography. So you've done some amazing stuff in your life. I didn't know some of these things about you. So let's talk about some of that. Which was more stressful and possibly different answer, but what was most rewarding between the following three things? Mm-hmm. Prepared food for Paul Allen's personal mm-hmm. aircraft. You made desserts for Bill Clinton's presidential state dinners. Mm-hmm. And you presented high tea to Princess Diana. Those are amazing experiences. Between those three, which one was the most stressful and which was rewarding?
The state dinner. I mean, just because of the, just a quick part of, we were baking off site and we all had to have background checks from the Secret Service kind of thing. And they had to come in, you know, you're baking and these guys in suits show up and it's like, okay, what's going on? And then when they delivered the desserts for the dinner, they forgot one of them. And it was actually a pear tart that was specifically for Bill. And it was the panic of trying to get to the venue, which was a Rainier Club, and trying to get to the venue with all of the, because you have not just the Seattle police and the state patrol and the Secret Service, but you have all the other foreign dignitaries, the Prime Minister of Japan and, you know, Prime Minister of Canada. So you've got all of this like paramilitary surrounding the venue. And we've got to get a dessert into the place. And Martha, who is my coworker, she brought a bunch of cookies. And we get out of the van and we're in the parking lot. Somebody's coming out to meet up with the tart and everything like that. We come out with cookies and there's guys with guns and body armor. And it's like, she's like, do you want a cookie? And they're like, and it's, the next thing you know, it's like, We've got cookies on, we've got cookies down here, and people are like coming out of the bushes with like their goggles and been,
Did you get a cookie?
yeah, there's chocolate chip. Yeah. And also it's there just because, you know, you're dealing with all of that going on.
I love it. Like, make room for the tart.
We've got the tart.
We've got Bill's
tart. Is this a presidential tart?
I always feel like one of the biggest decisions that we make in life, and certainly as we get older, is a very simple one. Mm-hmm. Do we want to work for ourselves or do we want to work for somebody else? Mm-hmm. You've done both. In fact, it's rare that like you do one and then you bounce between the other. So let's talk about that, because a lot of people in our business, our industry, mm-hmm. they're thinking about at certain point going into business for themselves. And you did that. So your restaurant here in Seattle ran 5 years, if I'm not mistaken, Sapphire Kitchen and Bar. It was got an international acclaim, very storied restaurant. So you were working for yourself. You were a business owner. Looking back and talking to somebody that might want to start their own business, what are the pros and cons of working for yourself versus working for somebody else?
Well, working for yourself, there is that thing of being able to have your grand design. I mean, and being able to have, I mean, and that's that whole thing about building something, whether you're building, you know, when you're building a restaurant, and there is that creative piece of being able to kind of create this environment from floor to ceiling. And, you know, when we put a, like at Sapphire, we put a mosaic on the ceiling and we had art specifically in the color scheme. And what was that, being able to kind of create that, because it's like an art installation in a lot of ways. You're creating this environment for the customer, and you want them, and this is where the theater piece, that thing, it kind of goes back and forth. It really is, it's like theater, and that you're creating this performance space for all these people to come in and get this experience. And especially with what we were doing, because it was described as colonial Tangiers, because we did this Pan-Mediterranean. And so it was really, Catherine Robinson called it like a place you'd find like a Bogey and Bacall hanging out. And it was really a cool spot. And then there's that freedom, but then the downside is, you know, you're the one that's got to pay the bills and do the taxes, and it's on you. I mean, if it doesn't succeed, you can't complain about the boss, because you are the boss. And it's very rewarding. One of those things where if you have the opportunity to do something like that, if somebody, I mean, that's part of the reason came up in the space and everything kind of came together. And I was like, you know, I don't want to say I never. I don't want to say I don't want to regret not having done it. This is what I always tell somebody. If you want to open a restaurant, if you want to start a business, whatever it is you want to do, I say, do it, because you don't ever want to regret not having done it. And trust me, you'll learn more from running, you know, opening your own business. You'll learn more about yourself. You'll learn more about this business that you're in, whatever it is that you want to do, because you really have to understand every piece about it. I mean, from bureaucracy on down, you know.
What did you learn about yourself? The process.
Wow, a lot. That I really love food, and I really love wine, and I really, really love that. I really love that bringing people together, and I think my revelation came, and I was talking to my staff, and we were having a meeting, and I said, "What do we do here? What are we doing here? What are we doing?" And then people are like, "Oh, we're doing high quality fine dining, and you know, customers." And I really had an existential experience. I said, I think Table 22, they're on a first date. If it doesn't go well, they may not have a second date. Table 15, if this date doesn't go well, they may break up. You know, their marriage may be over. Table 42, there's four ladies that haven't seen each other in 20 years. What we're doing is creating this environment and this space where these people's experiences are going to be what they remember and they recall. Yes, the food has got to be good. The wine's got to be perfect. The coffee, you know, the music, the lighting, all of that's got to do its job. But our job is actually to take care of these people and have their evening go the way it should. And if they're happy, they'll tell their friends, we had this wonderful time. And it, you know, it doesn't matter if they ordered you know, what food they ordered or how they ordered it. It's about that experience of those. I'm shepherding those people through their evening, and it's more about their interaction than it is way above anything about the food or the wine or the dessert or anything like that.
Now, as an owner, as the chef, mm-hmm. you were in quote unquote control mm-hmm. of everything mm-hmm. to a point.
Mm-hmm. Theoretically.
right. Mm-hmm. And I'd imagine that's can be incredibly frustrating for any business owner, be it in the restaurant world or not. It's like, as your company grows, you're no longer one person. You're 20 people. Now you're 40 people. Like how did you kind of navigate that, where that server or that person furthest away from you, technically, in terms of like caring about the work and the job, how did you navigate getting to them?
This is where having a strong philosophy about what you're doing and being able to communicate that more than the how far away the napkin needs to be from the edge of the table, or you know, whether or not we put, you know, 2 pinches of salt or 4 pinches of salt. The philosophy of what you're doing when it comes to customer service and hospitality, and really in the old Latin term of hospitality, of hospice, of a guest coming into your house, if you can instill that in your staff, that philosophy, that feel, that love, right? Because it's really about love and caring and empathy is really what hospitality is all about, is putting the customer first, right? And putting their needs before your break or before your phone call or whatever it is, you need to be able to put them first. And if you can instill that feeling in your staff where it's instinctual for them, then you're good. And you look at the people that have been really successful in like the restaurant business, they've been able to do that. People will carry that with them and they'll take that with them. 32 years ago, 30-something years ago, I worked at Cafe Sport, which is where Tom Douglas got his start. He'd already moved on and had started Dahlia at that point. But there were people that worked at Cafe Sport that are still working with Tom Douglas today, you know, 30 years later. You know, you look at Canlis and what, you know, Chris and Alice and what with the kids and what they've been able to instill. And people, one of my best friends, Jeremy, worked at Canlis for 17 years. The reason people don't leave restaurants and don't leave working spaces like that is because they feel good about what they're doing. And one of the things I like about, I'm in a metropolitan market, and Terry Halverson, who is the founder and still chairman of the board of Met Market, one of the things that he gave me, the permission he gave me, was to make sure I take care of the customer. Because it's so much easier to make the customer happy. It's so much easier to take care of the customer when you're given the permission to do so than it is to try to, oh, we can only do so much to make you happy, yeah. You know, and you're not getting that piece. But yeah, it's all about instilling that philosophy in the people around you.
I'm going to push back. Like, of course, you're 100% right. Mm-hmm. But how the heck do you do that? Right?
If there was a formula, a cocktail, a recipe, yeah, I could give you.
Dose all your employees. And
yeah.
I mean, it is a constant battle, right? Mm-hmm. To like keep people inspired.
But part of it, and again, in large part, one of the hardest, and this was again, the hardest lesson, because again, I'm old school chef. There are layers of darkness that you don't want to see, you know, but, you know, is learning that you have to treat your employees like you want them to treat your customers. You have to treat, if you want your staff to treat your customers like their guests in their house, like their family, right? You have to treat your employees like their family, and you have to put the needs of your staff before the needs of yourself as a proprietor, as a chef, as an owner, as a
manager. That's such an enlightened look and amazing, right? I mean, that's Danny Meyer. I mean, that's like the hospitality sense. Is that something that you opened Sapphire with on day one, or is this something
No, that was a lesson I learned. That's probably the biggest thing I took away from it. And it has affected how I taught culinary school. It affects how I teach my classes at South, what I try to instill. I actually, one of the projects this quarter, if I got them working on a group project where they have to work together, and there's actually a contract they have to sign to kind of come up with the rules of their engagement. because it, and again, this is, we talk about this infinite item, you know, the, because I say the wine industry, right, is the relationship industry, right? It's the relationship between that grower, between like the Dick Bouchers and the Mike Sowers and the winemakers, and the winemakers and their relationship with their, you know, their reps and their supplier reps, and the relationship between those reps and the buyers, and, you know, and the buyers and the wine stewards and the sommeliers and their customers. It's all about a relationship. And really, people that are successful in this industry have really good relationships. It makes it so much easier to navigate the, you know, this crazy industry when you have those relationships in your back pocket.
You are really good at relationships. I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but like you're very well connected to people in Seattle and probably around the country, but definitely here in terms of like people in the restaurants, people in the retail world, people in the wine industry, people that are selling wine, distributing wine, like you know so many people. What's the key to relationships? What do you tell somebody that's new to this business that they want to make their way, and you just told them that relationships are important? So what do you tell them to focus on?
Be nice. No, I'm serious. It's like, be nice. It's well, the hardest part, and I usually try to beat it out of my students very nicely, but the hardest part is to get over your opinion. And it, again, when it comes to, because a lot of people, oh, I like wine, or I like red wine, or I don't like this, I don't like that. And the hardest part is to kind of, you're going to have an opinion, right? You're going to have an opinion, but your opinion isn't really, nobody cares. You know, it's about, yes, you should know what you're talking about. You should know why, what makes Chablis Chablis, what makes Pouilly-Mont-Chartier, what makes Carnero Chardonnay versus stuff from the Willamette Valley versus, you know, stuff from Celilo or even in Washington State, being able to understand the differences. And you're going to have a preference, but it doesn't really matter because, you know, it's all about what you're going to be communicating to the customer and answering their question.
So is it a humility to put your own knowledge and your own preferences to the side and really listen what they want? You used an example to me one time that shocked me. You're a chef, and I think you said you don't like seafood.
I don't eat fish.
Fish. what is this?
Well, okay, I can eat fish. I don't feign any sort of allergy or thing, and that, like, and you know, I'm not fish intolerant. Just where I grew up, and you know, and how I grew up, and I just never really, trust me, I get invited to these dinners, you know, where, you know, if I Dom Perignon, I'm sitting there with Dan McCarthy and a bunch of the top guys in town. We're having all this Dom Perignon and sushi, and I'm digging in and I'm having a good time because I can still appreciate it from an artistic standpoint, right? You know, as a creative, I teach sushi, you know, I teach people how to make sushi, but there's a lot of wines out there. I won't name anybody, but there's a lot of wines out there that aren't my favorite. I have a friend in California who makes some really, really expensive, really, really big wines that are really highly rated. And he loves telling people how much I hate his wines. And it's not like I hate his wines. I respect, but he loves telling people how much I hate his wines. And it's like, and it's not, you know, and again, it's not because I hate his wines. They're just not for me. You know, I mean, you know, I like lighter, lower alcohol reds. You know, I love Beaujolais. I love Barbera. I drink more white wine than red, but you know, I need to be able to sell Australian Shiraz, and you know, I sell a ton of things like Molly Duker, and I sell a ton of wines from all these places, depending on what the people want.
Yeah. You know, and again, told me at one point that one of your most famous dishes from Sapphire was a fish dish.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting analogy, right? Because it kind of goes back to the example you were using before about the woman that you worked with that, you know, understood that Riesling was what she thought was best, and she was pushing it.
Or that's what she's been told, you know.
Yeah. Do you feel like that's one of the things that people in the wine industry, be they on the retail floor or on the restaurant floor, that they need to learn, is it's not about their own life?
Well, I mean, it's Dunning-Kruger, you know. Are you familiar with the Dunning-Kruger effect? It's this thing about the, it's basically the more you know about something, or the least you know about something, the stronger your opinions are, right? The more confident, you know, they did all this study and they found that people that knew very little about a subject had very strong opinions and were really confident in their answers. And generally people, as they went along, and the greater the mastery they had in whatever subject it was, the less confident they were in their answers. And you'll see this when you talk to, you know, I don't know who you've got coming up, but you'll see the next time you interview a master somm or a master of wine or some PhD, and you'll hear them say things like, well, to the best of my experience, or generally we agree, it's agreed. And they always couch their answers, because when this is the thing, when you meet, you know, because you run with, you know, these guys, it's like, once you've gotten to be a master somm, you realize how much you don't know, right? Once you get to be, you know, a master chef, once you get to be whatever that is, the skill that you come in, you realize you don't know anything.
Talk about this then, because it's a business too. And I think sometimes that's the biggest thing that young sommeliers, wine buyers, whatever, if you're retail restaurants, that they need to learn is it's the business, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about how you then approach making a wine list or making a retail set at your store. How do you take what you like and mesh that together with what you think the world of wine likes? Because you do have influence over what people might be discovered or looked at. How do you kind of navigate what your preferences are and what you like versus what you think should be on the restaurant or the retail shelf?
Well, Pareto principle. Another thing, the 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of your sales are going to be off 20% of your items. 80% of the productivity of your staff is going to be off of 20% of your staff. Hmm. You know, it's a principle that economic principle that kind of can be applied across so many areas. So basically, like in the store, all my top 20 items, all my top 20% of my items are all stacked. You know, La Crema Chardonnay is my number one selling Chardonnay. So I have it stacked. I have a double face on the shelf and I have double face in the cold box. So I never run out. Now the thing is if, and this is the same in a restaurant, you know.
Explain what that means real quick. Explain what that means when you say you have it set and you have it double faced. What does that mean?
Oh, sorry. Retail. You know, when you have a shelf and you have the wine on the shelf, I always have two facings at least on the shelf of the La Crema. You know, a lot of stuff like the flowers, the Farniente, the, you know, the Chateau Montelena, the Gurgitch, I only need one facing of.
Meaning as simple as there's two bottles in line next to each other.
Yeah, and going all the way back. So I've got, and so basically at any given time, I have about 8 cases of La Crema in the store. And it's my number one selling Chardonnay. I never want to run out. Now, there's a lot of people who have been like, I don't like La Crema. And so they run out. They don't actually maximize the potential. The thing about retail you have to remember is that if I don't have La Crema, if I don't have Kendall Jackson, if I don't have Fouve Coco, they're going to go across the street and get it from somebody else. In a restaurant, it's a little bit different, but if you don't have food available that the customer likes, they won't come back, right? Let me use an example on the food side. I always had vegan dishes on my menu, and I wouldn't call them out with dancing carrots or anything. But people are like, is this vegan? And they're yes, yes. And is this vegetarian? Yes, yes, it is. Because most of my friends live in mixed marriages. You know, she's a vegetarian, he eats meat. He's a vegetarian, she eats meat. So all my friends that have these mixed marriages could come in and dine away and have a great time. And it's one of those things, if you make those foods available to those people will come back because they know that they can get what they want, something that they can eat there. And it's the same thing. So when you have, by making sure that I have those, that 20%, whether retail or on a wine list, that those wines that people are going to come in and buy, whether I don't really even have to push them, right? They're just going to buy them. That gives me 80% of my set, 80% of a wine list to play. Because if I've got my basic categories covered, right, I've got all those basics that people want, then it's like if I'm really digging Etna wines right now and I want to have just kind of go deep on Etna, and because that's where I'm geeky about, or I happen to really like Albarino, you know, as long as I've got all my other, if I got that stuff, if I'm taking care of the customer, dude, there's plenty of room to play. it's not an either or. There's a, and people get very, it's almost like a religious sort of true believer kind of thing where people, it's like, I'm only going to have grower champagne, you know, I'm only going to have natural wine. Right. Which is, but there's, it's one of those things where, you know, people get this and it, and that's cool. Right. But I'm not here to, you know, I'm going to have vegan dishes on my menu, but that doesn't mean, you know, I mean, unless I'm opening up a straight up vegetarian restaurant, you know, I don't necessarily mean to just make everything vegetarian, you know, but you can, it is, it's about, because again, it's about the customer. It's about accommodating the guest. Now, but then there, and again, there are those people that are going to come in and just buy Rombauer because that's all they drink. There are those people that are going to, you know, they're only going to spend $10 on a bottle of wine. There's people that don't want to spend $100 on a bottle of wine. There's all these different types of buyers out there. There are people that know wine. One of the things I love about my little island bodega out on Mercer Island is my customers are really well-traveled. They know wine. They're well-educated. Makes it a wonderful place, but it's one of those things where you're going to have all kinds of people. Some people are just terrified. About 25% of the customer base is just absolutely terrified about buying wine. They like wine, but they don't know how to pronounce things. They're incredibly intimidated, you know, and a lot. And if you can be a gentle guide for them, you know, you've got a customer for life.
Support your state one sip at a time and drink for Washington. The wine the world is talking about is farmed and made by families right here. Now they need your help. So sip a cab or chill with rosé. However you enjoy wine, just make it a Washington wine. Raise a glass. Support your local wineries and drink for Washington. Brought to you by the farmers and families of Washington Wine, who encourage you to sip responsibly.
You've seen a lot of financials. You've seen a lot of P&Ls. You've seen restaurant P&Ls. You've seen retail P&Ls. They're very different businesses. For those people that maybe worked in restaurants their whole life and they're like, oh, you know what? I want to open a wine shop. You know, it's better hours, whatever the yeah. whatever the reason is, right? What do they need to know? What are the main things that you've learned? If you could speed up 20 years of learning about retail, jumping into retail as a wine buyer, as a person building a wine set, in addition to everything you just said, what are a couple more like, yo, you got to learn this right now if you're going to embark on that?
I think the big jump is volume, you know, in terms of like, you know, because when you're buying for a restaurant, you're kind of, again, like we created this colonial Tangiers, you know, Moroccan kind of environment for Sapphire. And so when we first opened the restaurant, the entire wine list was Spanish, right? And then we kind of, as we went along, we broadened that landscape. And so when you're doing it, when you're building a restaurant, it's very much about the customers coming to you and they're having the experience you're giving them. When you're working in retail, the customer is looking for something in particular. They're coming in and they want that wine that they had at that restaurant 40 years ago, with the one with the blue bottle. You know which one I'm talking about? The guess the grape. The, you know, the Psalm thing, guessing the grape. Where that knowledge comes in handy is being able to guide a customer to a wine when you don't have what they're looking for. Because the big difference between retail in terms of is a selling wine restaurant versus retail. You're having the halibut here. I'd recommend the Chablis. Oh, that sounds lovely. The customer comes in and they're like looking for a specific wine and you're like, well, I don't have Kim Crawford, Sauvignon Blanc, but I do have, you know, Jules Taylor, and she used to be the winemaker at Kim Crawford, or I have Lubbock, and this is Kim Crawford's new winery after he sold Kim Crawford. And that's where the knowledge comes in, is being able to guide somebody in not being pedantic, but being able to say, they come in and go, I had this wine. It was really good. It was from, you know, such and such vineyard, and it was such and such winery in Oregon. And you go, well, I don't have that, you know, but I do have this. Do you have the Cote Bonneville Riesling? No, I don't. And I love Carrie's Riesling. But you know what I do have? I have David O'Reilly's Dubrow Vineyard Riesling under their own row label. And it's all the same fruit. oh, that's great. And that's where that knowledge comes in handy, is being able to guide people through that type of thing. But
you have a limited set though, right? Yeah. Like you have limited shelf space and yeah. you've got tens of thousands of wines mm-hmm. that you could put on those shelves. Mm-hmm. Like in terms of nuts and bolts business, like what needs to be on those shelves? Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you've already mentioned like having those staples that like mm-hmm. everybody asked for. Okay, they're on the shelf now. Mm-hmm. Now you're left with say 80% or whatever. Mm-hmm. What do you put on the other ones? How do you as a wine buyer decide who gets that placement?
Well, a lot of it's actually, and this is the hard part, is it's got to be about listening to the customer. It's got to be about what are people looking for? You know, what was it, 15, 16 years ago when I first went into retail, Australia was everything. You know, Australia, I mean, and so I was doubling the amount of linear feet. I had a huge Australian Shiraz set because that's what everybody was buying. And now Australia is not, it's a couple of shelves. It's not two big sections. And so it's what are people asking for? And just constantly polishing, constantly upgrading, constantly adding to the set. Right now it's people want natural wines. People want wines with lower sulfites. People want wines with lower alcohol. And finding those wines that fit what people are looking for, that actually are of a quality that I can bring into the store. You know, even, you know, and that's that constant process. What are people looking for? What are they buying? What are they interested in?
That's why it's important for you to be on the floor talking to these people.
Mm-hmm. It's also important to interact, go out, see, look at what's going on. You know, what are the restaurant wine programs that are being successful? What are the wine bars that are doing great work that people are talking about? What are they doing that is innovative or different? Or what segment of the populace are they tapping into? And being aware, I don't know all the answers. I don't know what everything is. I'm just paying attention, you know, to what people are doing.
And you're paying attention on the back end as well, right? Like what you bring in, you're also looking at what's selling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
what do you see in the numbers? How do you read the numbers?
Oh, well,
how do you read the runes?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like I'm constantly checking numbers and I'm constantly cutting things out. I'm constantly culling things that aren't moving. And sometimes it's hard because sometimes the wines are from friends of mine or people that I know or. I mean, I had a sales rep push back because he's like, what do you mean you're cutting that out? And I said, well, you know, it's not moving, da, da, da. And he's like, but, and I go, hey, look, and I won't name the winery, but it was, but I look, it's a friend of mine. I've been camping with him. I don't go camping. He dragged me out camping. I don't go camping. My idea of camping is Paradise Lodge or Lake Quinault Lodge, you know, where I can go and there's nature and I can have a hot shower and a glass of wine. And, you know, and I said, you know, he's a good friend, but the wine isn't moving. And I find that with winemakers, my relationships with winemakers, because I'm just following what people want. And I had a winemaker friend of mine and I told him, look, the only wine that would fit would be this one. And it doesn't make any sense for me to bring in one wine from your winery. And we're still friends. And it's because, again, there's too many good wines in this state.
Yeah.
You know, there's too many good wines, period.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with what people are buying, taking myself out of the equation,
yeah.
You know, and what are people buying, you know, and I mean, you know, it's like somebody asked me about how do you increase sales? I said, well, when people buy a wine, I get more of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like people are into Shiraz 16 years
ago. You can't force people to drink it, right? Mm. You can put like a flashy sign on it. And you can do as much as you can to draw attention to it. But ultimately, they're the ones that decide, right?
It's all about pull through. It's all, for me, the goal is to get them to buy a case. So if they come, if I sell them a bottle and they come back and buy a case, that to me is always a goal because it's all about pull through. If you're pouring, if you got a wine program in a restaurant and you got a glass pour and I'm sitting there at the counter watching people and somebody goes, what else you got after they have a glass of wine? I get rid of that glass pour because I don't ever want them to say, you know, no, I want them, oh yeah, can we just leave the bottle? Can we just get a bottle of that? That was really good. You always, it's all about pull through. When I was teaching culinary school, the kids would ask, how do I get a 4.0? How do I get 10 points? And I go, well, if I can put my fork down, it's not good enough. I have to want to have another bite. Yeah. If I don't want another bite, or I can live without another bite, it's not good enough.
It's the yummy factor, right?
Yeah. And again,
at the end of the day, I don't care how beautiful that dirt is and how great that incline of slope is and how rare the whatever is, if it's not yummy and delicious.
This is the thing, because once you put that as your benchmark, is it's got to be delicious. It's so funny, you start paying attention, you see people apologizing for wines all the time. Oh, well, you know, it's a season or blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, no apologies, no wines, no apologies. It's like, you know, it's got to be delicious. And again, and this is where, again, you got to separate the ego, right? That wine has got to be objectively delicious, right? And again, this is where the not eating fish, you know, I got to make a dish that is objectively delicious, that, you know, like Braden put in the my salmon with Pinot Noir and black mustard sauce, which was our signature salmon dish at Cafe Sophie 30 years ago. And it's been grandfathered in that book. And the thing is it's a wonderful little dish, really simple. And get the Piper's Market cookbook if you want it. But it's that thing where, but this is artistry, you know, it's like, you know, the music's always a good one. It's like, just because you don't like country music, you know, doesn't mean that Dolly Parton is one of a natural treasure. You know, just because you don't like opera doesn't mean that Luciano Pavarotti didn't know how to sing, or Giuseppe Verdi didn't know how to write an opera. You know, it's like your people confuse their personal opinions with objective quality. You don't like hip hop, or you don't like this, or you don't like, for me, I'm very ecumenical in my musical taste, and it's all across the board. And it's one of those things where there is great music all over the world in all different types of styles. There's great wine all over the world from all these different climates, from all these different places, in all these different grapes, in all these different styles. Now, yes, I love bossa nova. I love Brazilian tropicalia music. Is that for everybody? No, but I can still love it.
I mean, there's enough good art out there, mm-hmm. enough good wine out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That you should just be appreciating what you love and great. Yeah.
It's like, this is where like the classics make it easier, right? Again, somebody interviewed me once. They asked, okay, Lenny, who's got the best wine list in Seattle? And I said, well, that's hard, because of course, Wild Ginger, you know, Canlis, you know, but that's kind of a different league. You know, and that's kind of a different, because, you know, of course they're going to have Latour, and they're going to have Palmer, and they're going to have all the Grand, all the Tête de Cuvée, all the greats. And it's, but, you know, I mean, it was, and I said, Matt Jenke, when he had the original Massive Market, the little one, and this is how long ago that was, again, 20 years ago. And he had always had like maybe 8 wines on the wine list. They were always fantastic, and they always went really well with his food. And so in my opinion, that was like the best wine list in town. And yes, and all props to Shane and Nelson and Robert and everybody at Canlis, everybody at, you know, Wild Ginger, everybody at these Met Grill. But there's all the, you know, props to those guys. And that's wonderful too, you know. But when you're buying, okay, I need all 5 first crop Bordeaux. Okay, I need all the Tête de Cuvée champagne. I need all the, you know, it's more of a shopping list than it is.
Right.
Yeah.
When you, so you got a good creative.
Yeah. When you see a restaurant that's, you know, got really interesting food, and they've got a bunch of really interesting wines that pair really well with that food, that to me, that's a hat trick. That's where you've got something going on.
I love that. Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to do some rapid fire questions.
Oh God.
What is the most obsessive habit you've brought home from the restaurant kitchen to your house?
Obsessive cleaning. Obsessive cleaning. Absolutely.
Any particular thing that you clean obsessively, or just everything?
Well, just the kitchen. It's like the rest of the house, well, bathroom too, but the rest of the house can kind of go, but there's a washer and sanitize. You know, it's like, you know, one of those things of cutting boards and spray bottles of bleach.
Is your kitchen just like completely mise en place? Like I could blindfold you, spin you around, and you could find any tool that you need in the kitchen?
Yes. I often cook while asleep, and I often cook while intoxicated. And sometimes both.
But you know exactly where everything is. Mm-hmm.
And everything has a place, everything in its place.
What is the number one most surefire way for a home cook to up their cooking game?
Buy an instant read thermometer. You know, it's like Thanksgiving, my phone goes off the hook. My Facebook messaging, it's like off the hook. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I have to make Thanksgiving dinner. And I'm like, get an instant read thermometer, you know, and pull it out at when 160, and then, and it's like, but when it comes to making a great steak, there's techniques, but it's like having that instant read thermometer, just knowing what medium is, knowing what, I don't know how many times I've made like pork chops or pork for people. And they're like, this isn't pork. And I'm like, yes, it is. It doesn't taste like cardboard. And I'm like, well,
Well, that leads me perfectly to my next question. Mm-hmm. What's worse, an overcooked, really expensive piece of steak or an undercooked piece of chicken?
Undercooked piece of chicken.
To hit the guest's table.
Yes. Well, see, there, because there's
two considerations.
The undercooked chicken is worse, just overall, just wins.
Okay. Because it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's just gross. I mean, it's just gross. I mean, you can do steak tartare and a really good, and again, even a really good cut of, like a really good cut of ribeye or a really good New York, you can actually still digest it. You can actually still eat it if it's overdone. But yeah, undercooked chicken.
Okay.
Not sexy. No.
Mm. All right. Let's see. Would you rather be stuck on an island alone or in an elevator with an incessant talker?
Depends on how long for both. There's be like,
you don't know.
Yeah.
Gosh. At the start of it, you have no idea.
Yeah. My anxiety, I feel like my anxiety level is going up about the incessant talker because I do really well alone. I'm a high functioning introvert, I like to say. I do really well on my own in quiet, just me and my books. I would probably go with the island.
If I told you alone in an elevator or on a desert island with an incessant talker? Does that change the equation at all?
Alone in an elevator.
Who do you text the most?
God, who do I text the most? Well, I've got a couple of friends that I text the most, but it's truth be told, it's usually vendors. If I was to go open up my phone and look at it, it's going to be vendors. It's so much business happens. I don't talk on the phone. I don't like talking on the phone. And so my vendors will often text me about like this and that and the other thing. And
it's kind of a faster way to do business.
Yeah.
At a certain point. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, I don't need to talk. Let's just tell me what they're doing.
Yes. No. Six cases. Yeah. Yeah. Send me a pallet. Yeah.
What's your favorite kitchen smell?
Well, it has to do baking and it'd have to do probably with like cake or cookies. But, you know, that smell is like the best smell ever. You know, when you've got some baked good that's coming out in the morning and, you know, that's cinnamon rolls. It doesn't matter what it is, but that smell.
I wasn't going to ask you this, but now that you got me going, what's your favorite bakery in Seattle?
Bakery Nouveau.
Where's that?
Oh, West Seattle. And we worked together for a while at the Alexis and Sazerac Hotel Monaco, and he just does a fantastic job.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Last question for the rapid fire. Which one country, in your opinion, has the best food and wine pairings, bar none?
Well, Italy.
Italy's a big country.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was going to say. I was going to say Northern Italy. You said...
Okay.
Country.
I think
France does great job too.
You're fine, France. Don't worry.
Yeah, there's I think that there's, I mean, Europe, well, I mean, Italy though, the wines are so food. It's like, it's almost the whole concept of having Barolo without a Borsato is like insane, you know, and the whole idea of having a Zabucco without a Brunello or something it's the food, the wines need food and the food needs wine and more than And you can make that same argument. You can make that same argument about Italy or in a bunch of France, any of number of places.
Don't apologize for France. France gets enough love, okay?
Yeah,
you're fine, France. Okay,
if I want to kind of put a little part of it too is like France. There's a lot of beautiful wine, a lot of great wine, and you know you've got Bordeaux and Cabernet and those guys, and then you've got you know Burgundy and Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Beaujolais down a little bit, and then you've got more Pinot Gris and stuff in Alsace, and you know you've got, but there's like a good handful of grapes that are in France. And you go up just northern Italy and you're talking Piedmont, you know, you've got Nebbiolo and Dolcetto and Barbera and Fresa, and you've got, you know, all these crazy Petit Arvin up in Val d'Aosta, and you've got all, you know, Alto Adige, and you've got Kerner and Schiava. And there's so much, so many different wines in Italy. I mean, it's just... that are just grown, you know. It's like, oh, Fiano d'Avellino, and you know, Falanghina.
You can spend your whole wine career trying to get to the bottom of Italy, and you'll never get close.
Yeah, it's insane how many different ones are.
You're gonna hate me, but we're doing it, man. We're gonna do the Sommelier drawing challenge.
Okay.
You knew it was coming. Do you have your pen and paper?
Mm-hmm.
That's paper. Okay, I'm gonna set the clock for 45 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to draw your best Swedish chef while telling us about the wines of Alsace.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Because you just threw it out there. All right. Are you ready?
Go. Okay.
Go.
Well, okay. So I this is going to be hard. So Alsace, again, because the history of Alsace, it's been going back and forth between Germany and France. If you ask... the French, they tell you that the border is at the river. If you ask the Germans, the border is at the mountain. You know, and again, you'll see the same varietals. You'll see the same varietals there that you'll see elsewhere. Pinot Gris, Riesling, also Chasselas is another one you'll find up there. Really famous for their sparkling wines. And you know, let me see what else we have over there. Gewürztraminer, those guys. Generally, the wines are drier than the Rieslings like you'll find in Germany. Mm-hmm. You're trying to do it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm terrible at this.
Chef tools down.
Mm-hmm.
All right, chefs. All right, I'm very excited to see the Swedish chefs. Can you move them closer to the, I see nothing yet. Oh, whoa, a little closer. Hold on, stop. Perfect. Uh-huh. Come on, man. You said you weren't an artist. Look at that guy. He has character. That
looks like a self-portrait, actually.
Yes. That looks like the Swiss chef that trained you when you were 20.
Yeah. 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 Silvio.
Just channeled him.
He'd be shouting at me.
What shouts do you most remember coming out of his mouth?
Quick, quick, like a bunny, like a bunny. Quick, quick. It's like, make it pretty. Make it pretty. You know, he was a character. But again, it was a different time, and he was from a different time, you know. And, you know, and the thing was, is I remember when he came to my restaurant, when he came to Sapphire, and he had dinner, and I came out to see how everything was, and he had tears in his eyes.
Huh.
And he was so proud.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, that drawing is for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's for you, sir. And I learned a lot about Alsace. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, last question for you. You have lived Washington wine. You've grown up Washington wine. You know this industry better than almost anybody. What are you most excited about the future of Washington wine and where we are today?
There's still so much land that we haven't planted yet. You know, there's still so many places where we haven't really... you know, they haven't even begun to plant grapes. I mean, you look on the map, it looks like it's, you know, Columbia Valley AVA is this huge thing. There's very little of that actually planted. There's so many places where we still have yet to go up north of like Royal Slope and up in that direction. I mean, I'm super excited. You know, I think in the Columbia Gorge AVA and the potential there in terms of really making really exciting, cool climate, you know, wines. There's so much. I mean, we've barely scratched the surface. I was talking, speaking of Alsace, you know, Julian Trimbach. We were hanging out, and he's the 16th generation of his family to work in the family business, you know, because they've been around for 1,000 years. We've been making wine for 40-ish, right? You know, even California, you know, Gunluck Buncher's been around for 150 years. There's like, we're just barely scratching the surface. And the very fact that we have wines that are truly world-class, I mean, beyond like, I mean, 100, there's easily 100 really, truly fantastic wineries in Washington State that can hold their own against anything else on the planet. And there's another 400, 500 that are really good that hit that, you know, 250 that, you know, occasionally hit one out of the ballpark. And there's still so many people starting new. I just had a wine from Duclos Cellars, which is Toby, a graduate of the program at South. And these wines are gorgeous. And they just barely started. They just moved to Walla Walla. There's so much potential, right? And we're kind of reaching that critical mass in terms of like institutional knowledge, where people are sharing information, sharing experience, figuring out where the grapes should grow. I mean, the thing that Europe has is they figured out where to put Pinot Noir and where to put Chardonnay. They figured out where to plant these grapes, and we're figuring it out here. But you know, we're doing really quite well for such a young, nascent little wine industry. We got a lot to be proud of. There's a lot to be proud of here. We got a lot of really, and there's a lot of really good people. There's a lot of really good people making really, really good wine.
Thank you so much. I mean, you've been an incredible advocate for the industry. You've introduced so many great people to the wines of Washington. You've been such a great supporter of so many people in Washington. Like, you define relationships and certainly with Washington Wine. So thank you for all that. Thank you today, Lenny. Thank you all for listening. Stay well, stay healthy. This has been Somlight, and we look forward to seeing you next time with some of our other favorite wine people from around the country. Thank you so much, Lenny.
No, thank you.